Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says the seaweed is always greener in somebody else's lake. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and our other host, Lauren Vogelbaum, is not with us today, but she will be joining us again next week.
Yeah, hopefully my brain will also be joining us next week.
Where is it right now?
I tell you, my brain is it's under the sea, buddy. It's under the sea.
Down where it's wetter.
Yeah.
Or at least I've heard it's wetter. Yeah. I've actually never been under the sea.
What?
Well, I've swam in the sea. I guess I've, like, dunked my head under it.
Okay, but I was about to say, like, how have you managed to do that?
No, I mean, I've never been to the bottom of the ocean.
Well, I mean, depends on what part of the ocean you're talking about, too, right? Because when you're wading in, your feet are on the sand, right?
Okay.
But not, you don't mean to any significant
yes,
depth.
Yes, actually, I am an aquanaut because I went to the beach one time.
We're going
to
talk about aquanauts today, and aquanauts are they're people working with NASA to develop technologies and processes and various strategies for dealing with deep space situations and tech and tools, but we have to be able to do it here on Earth because, you know, if you want to test something to make sure that it can withstand the rigors of space or that it needs to, that it needs to be useful within a space environment, it's pretty tricky to do here on Earth.
Yeah, that's the thing we've actually talked about a bunch of times before in various ways. It turns out to be very difficult to simulate space on Earth cheaply and safely.
Yeah, we've got lots of different environments that that NASA uses in various simulations of space environments. Things
Mars colonists pretending to be Mars colonists out in the middle of the desert somewhere.
Right, or Antarctica or something like that.
But still they've got Earth gravity, they've got air.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. If they were to take their helmet off, they would not suddenly, you know,
turn into Ronnie Cox at
exactly.
the end of Total Recall.
Right. They would not do that. So there's also another way of simulating a space environment that does bring into account some of those issues that you would encounter actually out in space, and that would be doing this underwater. Underwater has several of the aspects of space. For one, we obviously need equipment so that we can continue to breathe while we're there.
Yeah.
And we can't just remove a helmet and be perfectly fine.
Right. So we have to sort of like practice donning the EVA suit and dealing with that. It has unusual pressure conditions, though I'd say actually going in the opposite direction from what we'd be dealing with in most of our environments we'd be going into in space. So like if you go to the moon or a spacewalk or the surface of Mars, you're going to be dealing with an unusually low pressure environment. Dealing with the bottom of the ocean is an unusually high-pressure environment, but still you're dealing with different pressure conditions.
Well, and also you have buoyancy.
Yeah, yeah.
And buoyancy can help simulate a low-gravity environment.
Yeah.
So whether you can add some weight to your suit, which will allow you to simulate different low-gravity environments. In fact, NASA does this all the time. And they do this through a program called NEEMO. NEEMO.
So this is going to be the main focus of today's podcast.
Yeah,
right?
We're going to be looking at the NEEMO program and what it does and, you know, how it works.
Jonathan, what does NEEMO stand for?
You know, it stands for truth, and it stands for science.
And the American way.
American way. It stands for NASA Extreme Environment Mission Operations.
Okay.
So, this is all about using the undersea environment to simulate space in various ways. And it's pretty cool what they do and how they do it and where they do it. And it's a clever engineering way to say, well, how can we test out these things here on Earth? We're not spending money and potentially putting people's lives at risk out in space where we don't know for sure this is going to work. How can we be reasonably sure it works by simulating it here? And it's pretty cool.
Based on the name, I'm going to guess that they operate out of a globe-trotting giant underwater submarine that is disguised to look like a narwhal.
Or either that or they, you know, are constantly being berated by an overly anxious father. You can't go out there, Nemo. That's the ocean. No, neither of those things are true. It is, in fact, takes place at a laboratory, an undersea laboratory.
Oh, well, that's pretty cool.
Called Aquarius. Now, I'm fairly certain that we at least alluded to Aquarius when we talked about underwater hotels.
Yes.
So underwater hotels, we've talked about how there are only a couple of those that exist, and they are very limited. It's like a one room thing.
Mm-hmm.
In one case, it was a underwater observatory meant for divers that wasn't intended to be an underwater hotel, but had been repurposed as one.
You've definitely talked about Aquarius on Tech Stuff.
Yeah.
I think I've heard you talk about
it. Yeah. So Aquarius is the underwater facility that at one point was located off the coast of the U.S. Virgin Islands. That's originally where it was when it was built back in 1983, and it was originally called the George F. Bond. Bond was a physician and saturation diver. Saturation divers, that's where you are diving to a point where the oxygen in your blood all gets dissolved, and then you can hang out in a pressurized environment that's at the same pressure as the ambient pressure of the water around you, and you just you hang out, you do science, you observe stuff, and it means you can also go in and out of the water without any sort of decompression because you are already at that ambient pressure. You have adapted to it. However,
yeah.
If you want to go back up to the surface, you've got to go through decompression before you can do it, or else you will get the bends.
So I understand that this guy studied how pressure affects the human body.
Yeah, he was actually a physician and a diver, and he was a specialist in undersea and hyperbaric medicine, and passed away in 1983. So this facility, when it was at the U.S. Virgin Islands, it suffered some damage. Mostly it was, well, for one thing, there's just wear and tear where stuff grows on it and everything. And you know.
Yeah. If you've ever seen one of these underwater, like, labs or facilities, they look like heck. They're just covered with junk and barnacles and stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't look like some sort of pristine, like, super villain lair or something like that.
Yeah.
I guess it's a little gnarly.
It's hard to clean the exterior of an underwater habitat.
And you might not even want to,
right?
Like, you might be wanting it to you know, not interfere with the various biome as much as possible. But anyway, it was damaged in 1989 because of Hurricane Hugo. It moved through the area and caused some damage to the facility. So it was airlifted out. It was actually, you know, detached and sent off to Wilmington, North Carolina, where it was refurbished and redeployed, but this time off the coast of Key Largo in the Florida Keys. So that's where it is now.
Well, wait. Now, is this a hotel these days primarily, or do they use it for science?
This one's used for science.
Okay.
This is a science one. Not the same one as the one that was used as a hotel. So this one was, until fairly recently, it was owned by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. And specifically, NOAA had the National Undersea Research Program as the administrator for the lab. But in 2013, NOAA decided to sell the Aquarius Laboratory. And in fact, there was a time where people were worried that it would mean that the scientific endeavors would come to an end. Because NASA is just one entity that uses this undersea laboratory. It's used for all sorts of stuff, from studying climate change, biology experiments, diving and medicine experiments. And also NASA uses it for the simulations of space. So it's used for lots of stuff. Fortunately, the Florida International University took ownership of the laboratory in 2013.
So they'll rent it out to NASA when they need to do their NEMO stuff.
They allow NASA to continue to do their NEMO projects.
So I wonder, what's it like inside?
It's cozy. First of all, to get there, you have to swim down. To reach the actual facility, you're swimming down around 47 feet, which is about 14 meters. That is not the bottom of the ocean. That's not the ocean floor there. The ocean floor is actually further down. It's at 62 feet below the surface, or just under 19 meters down. That's where the base plate is. So you can think of the base plate as being kind of the anchor point.
Yeah.
And then the facility itself is on some struts. There is actually an area called a wet porch, which is, or also known as the moon pool. The moon pool is an opening inside the floor of the facility, and you just pop up through that. And because the facility itself is pressurized at the ambient pressure of the ocean, you can just go from underneath, you pop under this one divide,
right,
go up through the moon pool, and then you're inside the facility.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. You don't even need a door.
Nope.
But because of the pressure conditions.
Yeah, the pressure keeps the water out. It's just like if you were to turn a bucket upside down and put it down into the water, the air is going to keep the water from coming into the bucket, right?
So it seems like it'd be really unfortunate if the facility got turned upside down.
That would not be good.
No.
Yeah. There are many things that would be not good if you were in this facility. Like structural weakness would be not good too.
Or if you lost the connection through your life support buoy.
Yeah, because this is not the lab doesn't receive electricity through an onboard generator. It doesn't have just oxygen tanks supplying the oxygen. It's connected.
It's got an umbilical cord, basically.
Yeah, exactly. It's got an umbilical cord that connects to a buoy that floats on the surface, and it's through that that it receives electricity and oxygen so that the people down below will be able to survive. Obviously, that is an important part of doing science, is the surviving part. Otherwise, it's hard to continuously make observations and test them. It's right next to a coral reef, and the science projects performed there can sometimes involve things like studying coral reef life cycles, not the NASA ones, but the other projects that happen in there. As for the facility itself, if you went inside of it, you would have about 400 square feet or 37 square meters of space to wander around. The wet porch area is actually an add-on to the facility. It's kind of bolted on. It's a squared off area that's bolted onto the end of this almost, it almost looks like a pill, like a gel capped style pill.
Uh-huh.
It kind of looks like that in shape. It's almost cylindrical. And part of that is because that curved wall structure is very sound and helps, distribute the pressure from the water so that you don't have these structural weakness points, right?
Yeah.
It just makes sense. So, the main entry is through that wet porch. There's also a hatch as well in case they need it. But also,
hopefully you don't need it.
Also, that's important for decompression. You know, they have to be able to, if they need to go back to the surface, they have to go through, I think it's 16 hours of decompression before they can leave.
Man.
Yeah. Cause otherwise you get the bends.
Hopefully you can read.
Yeah. I'm sure you can. They were talking about, like, I actually watched videos.
They insist you be bored.
Right.
It's part of the training.
It's like 16 hours. Like, you get a ball in a cup. Like, the ball is attached to a string. The string's attached to a cup.
Space is boring. You've got to prepare.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they actually, I watched videos of some of the guys who were down there for one of the previous NEMO projects. By the way, the reason why we're even talking about this is on July 20th, 2015, the 20th NEMO project starts on July 20th. But that means there have been 19 other ones. And actually, it was NEMO 19 that I saw videos from that crew. One of the members of the crew took a whole series of videos, and they are awesome. They are great. They show you around the facility. They talk about the science they perform and the experiments they're doing to test space procedures and tools. And it's really interesting to get, you know, an inside look at this. But it is really tiny. There are six bunks, so only six people can stay down here at a time. And they may stay up there for up to 3 weeks in a go. So 3 weeks of being down in this little can with five other people, and you can't go up to the surface unless you first go through 16 hours of decompression. That sense of isolation is an important part of what they're doing, because when you're in space, you are also isolated.
Yeah.
So it's not just about testing the equipment and the processes and the tools, but human psychology.
Right.
To test, you know, is this something we should consider doing? Because look at the stress it puts on people. And what are the best ways of dealing with that stress? And are there ways that can help decrease it so that this sense of isolation isn't overpowering or causing anxiety? Really interesting stuff. You also have windows, so you can actually see outside and see the little fishies swim by.
Oh, not the operating system.
No, you don't. I mean, you could have a computer that's running on Windows, but no, I mean that the actual facility itself has portals that you can look through and see the beauteous fishies as they swim by and possibly sing Disney tunes to you if you have ocean madness. Just kind of like space madness, but it's underwater.
It's the kind of madness you have to wait 16 hours to escape
right,
from.
Exactly. Which it sounds like some of the flights I've taken in the past.
Yeah.
The undersea environment does serve as an analog for space. Like we said, it's a hostile environment. So just like space, you have to have protective gear on in order to survive.
You've got to psychologically get used to the hostile environment.
Right. Yeah, that's very important. Just as the isolation is a factor, so is the factor of you've got to get used to the fact that you are in a place where without your equipment working properly, you will die.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that you have to be able to deal with, obviously. Navigating underwater is not easy, nor is traveling around in space. They've talked about how sometimes you encounter a current that's so strong that it's like walking against a really powerful wind, which could potentially be something that you would encounter on an alien world, depending upon where you're going. They also say that, they want to test the, basic tasks that would be really simple on a normal planet, right? Like, let's say we're on Earth, because we are, and we wanted to dig a hole. Give me a shovel. I can dig a hole. Assuming that the ground's not so hard that the shovel won't penetrate it.
Actually, I kind of doubt your hole digging abilities, Jonathan.
You know what? We'll test that after this episode. But, give me a shovel and a
patch of ground. Are you threatening to kill me? I can't tell.
I'm not threatening to kill you. At any rate, something that might be easy on the surface of Earth could be incredibly difficult in other situations. So, for example, if you're on a low gravity environment, how hard would it be to get a soil sample from that planet? Which would be a typical science experiment that you would expect astronauts to do on a different planet, like on Mars. So they've tested this by giving an aquanaut, which is what they call the crew that goes down to Aquarius to test this kind of stuff. They give an aquanaut a shovel. They weight the aquanaut down to the appropriate level that will simulate the amount of gravity they would experience on whatever destination they have in mind, and say, all right, here's the location you need to go to. We need a soil sample from that location using this shovel as your tool. And then they observe to see, does it work? Is it hard? How difficult is it? Is there some way of making that easier for people when they do go to Mars so that they're able to perform the science without it being, despite the tools instead of because of the tools? They want to make sure that the tools are useful and not an impediment.
Yeah, and I'm sure, it's got to be similar to extravehicular activity in space in that you're dealing with, like, hard time limits and stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. You are only able to stay out there as long as your oxygen, right? Supply is able to give you oxygen. So the people who are on these EVAs, the extravehicular activities, the same thing that they call them out in space, they refer to anything that requires you to go outside of the Aquarius laboratory as an EVA. And there could be dozens of them within a span of a full NEMO project. Like the one I looked at for NEMO, I think it was 15 or 16. There were like 22 EVAs planned over the course of it. And that's a lot. But you are limited by the amount of oxygen that you have with you, just as you would be in space. Sometimes you might have an umbilical cord attaching you back to the laboratory, just as you could have a spacecraft that had that same sort of feature to it. But even so, you're still limited. So that's important. And it's built in so that when these tasks are transferred from the undersea environment out into space, NASA can be reasonably sure that the astronauts will be able to complete them in the time necessary to do so. If it takes too long to do, then it needs to either be redesigned or abandoned.
Yeah, that's crazy. It's something that I think most people have never even thought about when it comes to space missions. Just like, how do you estimate how long it's going to take to do something in space?
And we're talking about everything from complex maneuvers. Like they have essentially the equivalent of the jetpacks that astronauts would use in space to move around, but they have the water version. Like, everything from something as complex as that to something as simple as moving through a hatch just to test to make sure that the suits, which are designed to be as close to spacesuit technology as possible, and the hatch itself are designed in such a way that the astronauts can easily move through them. Obviously, if they can't, then that's a problem. Something needs to be redesigned, either on the suit or on the hatch or both. And that's why they have these really extensive tests. It's to test everything from the people to the equipment to the actual methodology they're using. One other thing that happens in space is that, you know, the further away from Earth you get, the longer it takes for messages to get from Earth to you and from you back to Earth, right? We saw this with the Curiosity rover landing. People talked about how the rover had been on the surface of Mars for several minutes, but we didn't know if it had landed successfully. So while we're waiting to find out, it was already happily sitting, not happily because it didn't have emotions, but it was sitting there safely on the surface of the planet. But we had no way of knowing because it took time for the information to travel from Mars to get to Earth. It could only travel the speed of light. So, and while I say only, and the speed of light is the fastest thing in the universe, that's still a limiting factor. And so in order to simulate that, NASA puts in essentially artificial delays in communications and builds that into the various missions. So if people aboard the Aquarius lab need to talk to mission control, there's a delay. And there's a delay in the message coming back. It teaches people to be very concise and very specific when they are communicating, because if what they're saying is not clear, they have to wait sometimes up to 20 minutes for them to receive the message saying, "I'm sorry, I didn't understand that." And then you have to do it again.
Yeah.
And keeping in mind that the other people are waiting 10 minutes from when they said it before it gets to you, and then another 10 minutes for your reply to come back. It's very, it indicates the need for clear, concise communication. And it teaches, like, NASA how to make these sort of communications more effective.
You know, that's a class they should teach in college. They've got technical writing, business writing, creative writing, but they don't have communications styled for interplanetary radio transmissions.
Right. Obviously, I would fail that course. I'm a little
loquacious.
So the very first NEMO project began on October 21st, 2001. And like I said, we're moving up on NEMO 20 now. So, you know, was it like being there? If you watch those videos, you'll get a good feel for it. But like I said, it's tight quarters. You got six bunks. They're stationed at one end of the Aquarius lab. And you might have somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25 different EVAs planned for the duration of your mission there, depending on, and that could last as long as 3 weeks. You would end up testing out lots of different variations of the same stuff because really you're trying to gather as much information as possible about things that will potentially be used in space. So there have been NEMO missions where really it's been all about testing the same spacesuit in slightly different configurations to find out which one is the best one in under various circumstances.
Well, I mean, that's important.
It is. It sounds incredibly tedious, and granted, you're underwater. Like, you're surrounded by amazing marine life because you're not that far off the coast of Key Largo. It's not like you're in a desolate ocean environment.
Right.
So I'm sure there's lots of stuff to be like, ooh, that's awesome.
Oh, it's Cthulhu. Yeah.
But yeah, exactly. Like, oh, really? It's right down the street. But no, it's more about like, you know, you try out your spacesuit in one configuration. And then you try it on a different one, see if that makes any difference. Try it on a different one, see if that makes any difference. Then you do it with different weights because that's to simulate different gravity. And it may be that a spacesuit for the moon is not as ideal on Mars, right? You might find that one design works really well for moon gravity, which is 1/6 of the Earth's gravity. And others might be better for Mars, which I think is 1/3, if I'm not mistaken, of Earth's gravity. And so it's really important that you test out all these different variations, right? So once you've, you know, that's just one part of it, obviously. There's the communications part that I talked about, the isolation part. And these mundane tests are really critical because you want to make absolutely certain that every decision you make when you're sending people out on a space mission, particularly something like going to Mars, that every decision made is not going to endanger the success of the mission and the safety of the crew.
Yeah.
So things that like a hatch shape or size. They want to make sure that it's economically, wise. You know, they don't want to make a giant three-pronged space door where you could drive a Humvee through it because you need to have one astronaut go through. But at the same time, you don't want it to be small where your suit is catching on it when you're trying to get through or shaped in a weird way. So these tests are, while they're mundane, are really important. Also, there's a thing called the center of gravity rig, which is a fancy way of saying a backpack where you could put weights in different parts of the backpack to change the center of gravity of an aquanaut. And that helps NASA design spacesuit equipment that's both useful and safe by, you know, checking to see how this affects an aquanaut's ability to walk around on the surface of the ocean floor. While we are looking a lot at spacesuits and vehicle designs, that's a big part of what NEMO programs are all about testing is, you know, can you get in and out of a vehicle effectively wearing this suit? Obviously, finding out that it's not easy to do when you're on the surface of Mars is a little too late.
Yeah.
Right? So you want to be able to test that out, both the suit and the vehicle configuration to make sure that it all works together. Or you might want to just test how well you can maneuver and interact with different environments while wearing that spacesuit. This is similar to that idea of taking the shovel and trying to dig with it. Does the spacesuit get in the way? Is the shovel designed properly? Is there something else that needs to happen in order for this to be as easy as possible given the conditions that you have to work within? So it's actually a pretty huge challenge.
So what specifically is going on at this year's NEMO?
All right, well, it's going to be a 14-day mission starting on July 20th, as I said. And the main purpose is to test the tools and techniques that could be used by astronauts who are visiting Mars.
So really?
Yeah, specifically looking at a potential, like, if we are to send people to Mars, what are the best practices that we need to follow?
And this is NASA doing this.
NASA.
That's kind of surprising because I don't know. I haven't gotten a lot of... we're definitely sending people to Mars vibes from NASA.
Well, there's been talk about it for more than a decade. There's been serious talk for more than a decade about pursuing it. And, we have to keep in mind that
comes
NASA.
Comes and goes.
Well, yeah. And there are different departments within NASA, right? So it's, you know, saying that NASA says blah, blah, blah is a little misleading because
it's like saying the U.S. government says,
right? It may be in a single official who has no backing with anybody else. It's possible that happens. But this is a case where NASA is also working with the European Space Agency to test a lot of different equipment.
Well, that's cool.
And it's so millennial because it's all wearable computers. It's all things like heads up displays, tablets or smartphones. So you're seeing things like, a spacesuit designed to go underwater right now that has a tablet or smartphone type of device on one wrist so that
a Pip-Boy.
Yes, essentially a Pip-Boy. That's a good example. Or a heads-up display, which, by the way, at least for NEMO 19, I don't know if this is the case for 20. NEMO 19, the heads-up display, Google Glass. It was a pair of Google Glass. But the idea being that it would give aquanauts the ability to look at a series of steps without taking their eyes off the task at hand. So for an astronaut, you could understand this would be incredibly useful. It's kind of like thinking about the HoloLens, right? That you would be in a space environment, you're doing something important. I don't know. Maybe you're setting down a drill so that you can put a nuclear bomb in this giant asteroid that's heading toward Earth. And that way it has the list of instructions right in front of you so you don't have to look away from the big drill that's drilling down. And it would really make Bruce Willis's job much easier, is what I'm saying. Maybe it could show you the lyrics to Leaving on a Jet Plane so that way you don't screw it up. If I'm going to continue the Armageddon references, that, by the way, is the extent of my Armageddon knowledge because I've never actually seen that movie.
Oh, you haven't?
No, I have not.
Well, if you've ever got like 347 minutes to spend, or however long it is.
If I just want to make my life seem that much longer by watching something I'm clearly not going to enjoy.
Yeah.
So this is really cool, though, the idea that they'll be able to use this technology. And the reason why I say it's kind of the millennial approach is that they're going to be using, testing a lot of different apps as well.
Yeah.
To see which ones are going to make, potentially make the missions more easy to, easier to complete.
Sure, because, I mean, when you're going to space, you need to consider the effectiveness, not just of hardware, but of software.
Right. I mean, you know, what if you're on that asteroid and you want to play Angry Birds? You're going to, especially the Star Wars edition, which would be really apropos. No, but seriously, yeah, you want to be able to make sure the software is going to be useful. It's not just going to be like, oh, you can do it this way. You want it to make sense. You want it to be intuitive. You want it to be reliable.
Right.
And it's also going
Why
to...
Why is my spacesuit running OS2 warp?
Yes. Yeah. And it's also supposed to stay in contact with other parts of the mission. And it incorporates those communication delays we talked about earlier. So when one person is using their equipment underwater and they're requesting guidance from mission control, there's going to be that delay because just as there would be if you were in space and you were really far away from Earth, you can't expect an answer to pop up immediately. So it's to test that as well to make sure that this stuff is still useful, even given the restriction of a communications delay. Communications delays are also very useful in that it teaches how to improvise, right? Like you might have a problem that you have to address that you need some guidance on. You can do maybe some quick work to address it, mm-hmm. but you might need more guidance to actually solve it, right? That's the kind of stuff that they are looking into as well. The idea like, well, these apps may be able to help help in certain mission parameters while mission control is working for a more permanent solution.
Sure. It's Clippy for space exploration.
Yeah, I see that you're trying to establish a Martian colony. Would you like some help? The commander of this mission is going to be Luca Parmitano, who is an astronaut who has spent 166 days aboard the International Space Station, so 14 aboard the Aquarius should be pretty much easy. Pickens, it should be simple. A walk in the ocean park. And recent NEMO missions have also explored tools and techniques for astronauts who are attempting a landing on an asteroid. This one was really cool, the idea being that they used very little weight because they wanted to try and simulate a microgravity environment as close as possible.
Uh-huh.
And it involved them planting kind of like, sort of like harpoons or anchor points with ropes attached to them and creating pathways that way so that they would be able to maneuver from one part of an asteroid to another. So if they wanted to do something like take a specific sample from a particular part of the asteroid, well, obviously they're going to need to figure out a way of maneuvering around there. How do you get from one point to the other in a microgravity environment? That's what that test was all about.
Yeah.
So when we get to the point when we're ready to do that, because of the procedures established through the NEMO project, we'll have a better idea how to do that in a way that ensures success as closely as we possibly can. And that's really exciting. Those videos I talked about earlier, they were from NEMO 19. Andreas Mogensen, shot a series of videos while he was aboard the Aquarius, and they are great. He's enthusiastic, he's funny, and he is just really genuine in showing what they're doing, why they are doing what they're doing. He's even self-deprecating because he talks about how people think of astronauts as scientists. He's like, really, we're lab technicians. The scientists are back home, and we're just the hands that do what the scientists want us to do.
Yeah.
But
we're the people the scientists have deemed expendable.
Right. We're Bruce Willis. And it's really those videos. I cannot recommend them highly enough. They are really a great window into the training program, not even training, the simulation program. And in fact, there are some people who say that you shouldn't even call them simulations, just call them missions, because they so closely mirror what is going on in space missions that to call them otherwise is disingenuous. which was pretty interesting to me.
I think this is really cool. I had no idea about this program before we looked into it.
Yeah, it was one of those things that had popped up in my news feed about how this was coming up on the 20th mission. And I thought, well, what the heck is that? And when I looked into it, I'm like, well, that makes sense, but I had never really heard of it before. And so I really wanted to go into more detail. And this is the sort of stuff that I find really inspiring, the idea of how can we as human beings engineer a situation to mimic something inherently dangerous, so dangerous and so expensive and so difficult to do that there's not an easy way of testing that stuff, right?
Yeah.
To make sure it's going to work. And I thought it was a very elegant way of doing it.
Yeah. Until you can just put yourself into the matrix for space.
Yeah.
This is about the best you can come up with.
About as close as we can get to. So yeah, really interesting. Of course, obviously, if you are, turning in at night aboard the Aquarius, you're not dealing with microgravity anymore. You are, in a 2.5 atmosphere environment and just
so
laying on a bunk.
You can lay horizontal. You don't have to strap yourself into
right,
the sleep sack.
Right. Also, use of the toilet is slightly less complicated than it is in space. I will say that the Nemo 19 crew, one of them was from France, and he brought along with him French space food. So they were able to eat, because most of the food they had was like camping food. There's a microwave on board. That's it for the cooking. There's microwave and then there's hot water. Those are your two options if you want to cook something. So they ended up bringing these cans of French space food. It was actually in cans with pull tabs. And they had to heat it using hot water. And so I was curious. I was like, I wonder what French space food is like. Quail. There was quail. There was salmon. There was some pureed vegetables.
Duck liver pate.
I can't remember what the dessert was, but it was it was quintessentially French, and it was quite amusing to me. Anyway, those videos are all on YouTube. You can find those if you search for Nemo 19. They'll pop up, and I do highly recommend them. He also recorded video logs of his training process before going aboard the Aquarius. So it's all there. It's very good to check it out if you get a chance. And if you guys have any suggestions for future episodes of Forward Thinking, you should write us. Our email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, or you can drop us a line on Twitter, Google Plus, or Facebook. At Twitter and Google Plus, we are fwthinking. At Facebook, just search fwthinking and the search bar will pop right up, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.